Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulis. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulis.
So, welcome to the third and final episode of myth busting the belief that the Russians single-handedly won the Second World War, or that they won it with very, very, very little help from the Western allies. Hope you enjoy it, and I'm gonna continue this series with a new one starting next week on myth-busting the belief that the Nazis were these great military strategists, which they weren't. They actually sucked pretty bad. And thank God they were there, because maybe the German army may have won the war if not for the incompetent military decisions made by Nazis like Hitler and the rest of his idiotic homicidal maniacs. So enjoy this third episode, and please give me some feedback. The podcast's email is perimeterpodcast@gmail.com, perimeterpodcast@gmail.com, one word, and enjoy.
So this idea that the Russians fought by themselves up until Normandy is just nonsense. The only claim to fame that the Russians have in 1942, I guess, and 1943 is that a lot more, unfortunately, a lot more Russians were dying than were Americans and Brits. And let's face it, when the Brits and the French got their asses kicked after Germany invaded, and the Brits were literally running for their lives from Dunkirk. I don't remember the Russians being there to help the British. In fact, at about that time, if I recall correctly, Russia or the Soviet Union and Germany have an alliance. So let's move on to the big issue, the issue of D-Day itself. One of the claims that are made by a number of pundits, and especially Russian pundits or Soviet pundits, one of the Soviet arguments with respect to why they won the Second World War and therefore deserved to be a World Heritage country, including their bathroom installations, I suppose, has to do with the fact that they faced the brunt of the Russian, the German army. They did. When the Germans invade Russia in Operation Barbarossa in June of 1941, they essentially invade the country with about 150 divisions. A division, for those of you who don't know, is about 15 to 20,000 soldiers, versus probably around 200 Russian divisions. Now, when D-Day is going to take place, the Germans have at their disposal approximately 50 divisions in France, preparing for an invasion by the Western Allies. So, I mean, I know it's not the 150 or the 200, but 50 divisions is not exactly something to laugh at. Plus, the other big significant point to make here is that when the Allies do make the invasion, they make the invasion from water, which was something that had never been done at that scale. And we'll talk about the scale later. And the scale was actually about 7 divisions. So if we look at it in terms of pure proportions, although the Americans and the Brits were better trained and better equipped and so forth, proportionately speaking, the Germans had a much wider margin of troops to defend the invasion, to defend against the invasion of France than did the Russians have in the German invasion of Russia. I think I got that right. Another complaint is that, of course, you know, oh, these 50 German divisions were all like old men and little kids and stuff like that. Well, you know what? To be honest with you, those 200 Russian divisions that were defending against the Germans were divisions that were very, very poorly led because Stalin had essentially purged the competent officer corps before the war started. Plus your average Russian soldier didn't have particularly great training. So the kinds of disadvantages that the Russian army had when the Germans invade, this professional German army invades in 1941 in June, are the same kinds of issues that are being faced by the Germans when the Americans and the Brits and the Canadians land in Normandy. So the Russian argument kind of backfires on the Russians because you can use it both ways. You can use it for the German invasion of Russia, and you can also use it for the Western Allied invasion of Normandy. The Americans and the Brits and the Canadians were facing incompetent soldiers when they invaded France in 1944, while the Germans were facing incompetent Russian soldiers when they invaded Russia in 1941. But again, these 7 divisions, to get these 7 divisions to Normandy was just something unheard of. So many different things were going on, but I was going to say it's about logistics. Just imagine, like, you know, Amazon on steroids, basically, is what Eisenhower, as Supreme Allied Commander, put together on the part of the Western Allies. To prepare for the invasion, the Western Allies didn't just throw bodies onto the beach. First of all, they tried to, for example, mislead the Germans as to the date of the invasion and as to the specific location of the Allied invasion. So the Allies were much better at the issue of deception and much better at using intelligence and propaganda and counterintelligence than the Russians were. One of the most incredible things that the Western Allies did was that they created this fake U.S. Army group, the first United States Army group under General George Patton, who, by the way, was not going to be on the beaches of Normandy because he was being punished for being a jerk by Eisenhower. Patton's only gonna actually come back into the war when the Allies have landed and managed to secure a beachhead. So they created this like fake first United States Army group, and they had blow up tanks and blow up meaning like, you know, like it with air blow up, like plastic planes, rubber planes. They even played the music of trucks moving around constantly and vehicles moving around to give you the impression that there was really such a thing as the first U.S. Army group under General George Patton. The Allies knew that there were spies, German spies, Nazi spies in Great Britain, and that they were listening in, and this attempt at deceiving the Germans into thinking that George Patton was going to lead the invasion of Normandy was extremely successful. Something else that the Allies did, and this happened a little bit later in the war, but it's on the issue of propaganda. One of the most effective propaganda campaigns that was used by the Allies was that they airdropped these leaflets that looked like little diplomas, and I own one, and a real one from back then, from the Second World War. And the little diploma thing said that bearer of this document can use the document to surrender to any Western Allied soldier, and if that German soldier surrenders, then he will be taken out of the combat zone. There were a whole bunch of promises that were made. You're going to be taken out of the combat zone. You're going to be given medical treatment if you require it. You're going to be given food if you're going to be fed. You're going to be treated well in prison camps. You'll have access to the Red Cross. And it was actually signed. Well, I mean, not every single copy of it, but it was signed by Eisenhower, and it looked like a diploma. It looked very official, and it's one of the most successful propaganda campaigns that the Allies used, because the Germans were convinced that it was a much better idea to surrender to the West than it was to surrender to the East, or to surrender to the Russians. The German soldiers trusted, let's say, the Americans. Maybe not so much the British, especially after Dunedin, and they trusted, of course, the nice Canadians. And they knew that they would be treated well. Hundreds of thousands of Germans surrendered to the West. Now, you got to ask yourself, like, what's better here? Okay, is it better? And this is where we go back to the whole Russia thing. Is Russia considered a winner of the war because, in order for them to get the Germans to surrender a couple hundred thousand soldiers in Stalingrad, a couple hundred thousand German soldiers in Stalingrad, required the death of, let's say, 500,000 or 700,000 Russians? Is that any more important than or significant in terms of the contribution to the war than the West using a little piece of paper that convinces the German soldier to surrender? And they were surrendering in the same numbers. I mean, the amount, that document was so successful, literally hundreds of thousands of Germans surrendered. Yeah, so they didn't have to kill them. And no Americans got killed in that process. And no Brits got killed in that process. That's not a bad thing. That doesn't mean that you didn't make a contribution to the war. It just that means that you are a lot smarter than the Russians were. I know what a critic's going to say. But Hitler had like this, a racial thing with the Slavs, and he didn't have it so much with the Western countries, right? So therefore, he was planning to obliterate the entire Slavs. Well, yes, there's truth in that. However, let's not forget the fact that the Russians weren't particularly nice on the way back to Germany when they, when they started winning the war against the Germans and advancing. So essentially what we have here then is the claim to fame that both Germany and the Soviet Union have is not that they won the war, or let's speak specifically about the Soviets. The award that the Soviets get for the Second World War isn't that they won the Second World War is that they absolutely slaughtered everything in sight in order to win the Second World War. Whereas the Western Allies, well, they played a smarter game. It seems as though the Russians are claiming that, you know, they single-handedly won the Second World War because they killed more Germans. But how about this? Here's another way of looking at it. Who did the Germans surrender to when they were surrendering? They weren't surrendering to the Russians. They were surrendering to the West. So why can't we say that the West won the war because a much greater amount of German troops surrendered on the Western Front than the Russians killed on the Eastern Front. In fact, as the war was coming to a close, there was a massive refugee issue that the West had to deal with literally millions of Germans and other, you know, nationalities running for their lives, trying to get away from the Russians. They were, in essence, surrendering to the West. So I'm going to say that Mr. Putin, you know, the West won the Second World War because we managed to get a lot more Germans to surrender. And so what if fewer people were killed? That's a good thing. The Germans are surrendering to the West because they knew they'd get better treatment from the West. In other words, the Americans and the British, and I guess the French too, had won the hearts and minds of the Germans. The war was won that way. Why can't we make that argument? Why is that any less significant than the Russian claim that, you know, well, we had to lose 30 million in order to defeat the Germans? Well, you know, yeah, not so many people were killed on the Western side, and I guess maybe you could see that as a good thing. So here are some numbers that I think might be notable to highlight. So it's force ratios. In other words, comparing the number of soldiers that the Germans had versus the number of soldiers that the Russians, the Soviet Union and its allies had. And just to give you an idea, the beginning of March of 1944, the Soviet Union and its allies has about 6 million troops versus 3 million on the part of the Germans and its allies. The 1st of July, the Russians 7 million and the Soviet Union 7 million. I wonder where that extra 1 million is coming from. 1st of July 1944, hint, hint. And the Germans have about 3 million. Then in September, close to 7 million on the Allied side, including Soviets, and then a dramatic drop on the part of the Germans to 2.5. Then in October of 1944, still we're up to, you know, 7 million and 2 million Germans. 1945, when the war ends, 6 million on the Allied side versus 1.5 million on the German side. There appears to have been a sudden dramatic drop in the force ratio precisely at the moment when the Allies landed on D-Day. In other words, D-Day made a difference, and the Russians refused to acknowledge that. So there you go, Mr. Putin. Okay, so to kind of prove the point I'm trying to make with respect to how successful the Western Allies were in getting the Germans to surrender because of these promises that they were going to treat their prisoners of war well. Okay, so now these are percentages. Okay, so percentages of prisoners of war and how they were treated by each country. Not all the countries. I'm not going to go into every single one of them. But for example, Soviet prisoners of war that were held by Germans, 57.5% of them were killed. Okay, so the Germans were really nasty with the Soviet prisoners of war. Now, German POWs held by Soviets is the other side. Okay, so these are the Soviets who are holding the Germans. A little bit better, not that much. 36% didn't survive the war, let's say. The Japanese weren't particularly good with the Americans or with the British. 33% of American prisoners of war that were held by the Japanese did not survive the war. The Japanese were slightly better with the British. 25% of Japanese, 25% of Japanese, 25% of British POWs held by the Japanese did not survive the war. And now we'll get into the numbers for the Western Allies. So, French POWs held by the Germans, 2.58 did not survive the war. And that's actually a high number for the Western Allies. Americans holding German prisoners of war, 0.15 did not survive the war. I remember a number I started with, right, which was 58% of Soviets held by Germans did not survive the war, and then the second number was 36% of Germans held by Soviets didn't survive the war. Well, 0.15% of Germans held by Americans did not survive the war. And the British were actually kind of nice. The British, vis-a-vis the Germans, were really good at keeping their promises. British prisoners of war, British-German prisoners of war, 0.03 did not survive the war. So, I don't know. I mean, who are you going to trust that's going to follow the rules of the Geneva Convention? If you're German and you're looking at the Russians and you're looking at the West during powers, you're betting that you're probably going to get better treatment by the Western powers. And in fact, you did. So getting specifically into the actual invasion itself, it wasn't simply putting 150,000 soldiers on the beach. That was not an easy task. I mean, I don't know. I keep on telling my students it's all about logistics, because D-Day was really all about logistics, and Eisenhower is like the logistician, magician. There we go. That sounds good. The logistician, magician. And he was able to keep all this stuff together. And we're talking about, you know, like I said, hundreds of thousands of troops from different nations, coordinating activity in Great Britain, in the Channel, with the French resistance, which I'll talk about in a second. But that's something that I don't think anybody else really could have been able to do other than Eisenhower. And that operation, we look back at it now and we say, I mean, how the hell did this guy put this thing together? This is something that was just absolutely incredible. So let me get a little bit more into the details now. Eisenhower was using logistics, intelligence, propaganda, coordination with allies. I mean, Eisenhower was a logistician more than a military general. He put the pieces together, and he realized that in order for this to be a success, there were multiple pieces that had to come together, including, of course, the French resistance. As a side comment, very quickly, one of the things that Eisenhower was able to do was manage the conflicting personalities that exist in amongst the different generals in the Western Allied command system. One of the biggest, let's say, fight or jealousy was between General George Patton and Montgomery on the side of the British. Eisenhower was able to, let's say, finesse the differences between these different leaders. I mean, he was literally, he literally put together a landing force that consisted of commanders from multiple countries. I mean, Poland was on D-Day. This is something that the Germans were simply incapable of doing. Look, in the specific case of Stalingrad, the fighting that took place between the different generals over what should be done was something that really played a significant role in the ultimate defeat of the Germans in Stalingrad. Eisenhower's ability to bring together these different personalities from different countries was one of his strongest skills. And I actually think that when he was picked by Roosevelt to do this, because he was Mr. Amazon of 1944, plus also because he didn't have an ego like people like Montgomery and Patton, who felt win and for glory, for their own personal glory, in fact. Eisenhower didn't seem to be that kind of guy. In fact, if anything, he was a pretty humble kind of guy when he was Supreme Allied Commander. As you know, he eventually became President of the United States. First, they had to wipe out the Air Force, so that it wouldn't represent a threat to the Navy that was crossing through the Channel with those boats full of soldiers who were going to land on the beach. I just want to give you some numbers here that are just absolutely spectacular and unheard of before. We've never seen this even. We've never seen this since. I mean, the invasion fleet was from 8 different countries. So it came from 8 different navies. It comprised 7,000 vessels. Okay, Mr. Amazon. 1,200 warships, 4,000 landing craft of various types. Some of them for soldiers, some of them for tanks, etc. 736 support ships, 865 merchant vessels. Most of the boats came from the UK. You know, the Americans were number two, and the Canadians were close number three. There were a total of 200,000 naval personnel involved in the planning and execution of the invasion. That includes people at the actual ports, of course, but also sailors on those boats. Okay, so the actual fleet was split up into two. One of the fleets headed towards the two beaches where the Americans landed, Omaha and Utah, codenamed Omaha and Utah, and the other task force was headed for the three Commonwealth beaches that were going to be landed on. Two of them were British, one of them was Canadian. The Canadian beach is called Juno Beach. So they're going to land 5 divisions, is the idea. Their objective is to try to link those 5 beaches. They didn't succeed in doing that, but they did actually succeed in landing and establishing a foothold on the beach. Before all of this happened, before this, the actual landing took place, which was at 6 in the morning, more or less, on the 6th of June, 1944. The night before, 3 airborne divisions, 2 of them American, 1 of them British, were airdropped deep in French territory in order to secure the routes that the Germans had to supply the beach. In other words, the priority for the first few days of the landing at the beach was to be able to have a secure hold of the beach. So a total of 156,000 Allied soldiers from a multitude of countries landed or paratrooped into France the night of June 5, morning of June 6, 1944. 150,000. That's a staggering amount. That's logistics. I mean, Amazon would kill to be able to do something like that. Now, in terms of losses for the actual D-Day itself, well, they weren't that heavy. They didn't get the resistance that they were expecting, but that doesn't mean that things didn't get bad later, and we'll get to that a little bit later. On the first day of the landing, there were about a total of 10,000 Allied casualties, about 5,000 confirmed dead in 5 beaches, and also paratroopers, etc. And in terms of the German side, there were also about 10,000 casualties. But the big success of D-Day was that they were able to establish a beachhead. The problems that the Allies are going to have, and this is what people never pay attention to. They always pay attention to how hard everybody thought D-Day was going to be. It was hard. I mean, you heard the numbers, putting this together on the part of Eisenhower. It wasn't an easy task, especially with people like Montgomery and Patton Owen. I forgot it's somebody else, De Gaulle. Imagine having De Gaulle, having to deal with De Gaulle. And that's a special shout out to Gabriel Goodliff. People pay attention to just D-Day. What they don't realize that the breakout from Normandy, that's where the Allies started having some serious trouble and started seeing some heavy casualties. The breakout meaning trying to move away from Normandy itself. And there's a further thing that I think needs to be highlighted, which was the coordination between the Western Allies, specifically Great Britain and the United States, and the French Resistance, which proved to be very, very significant. On the Allies, the Western Allies, along with the French Resistance, implemented a plan to assure that the Germans would have difficulty in reinforcing the landing zones where the Western Allies were going in Normandy. So there were essentially 4 plans that were implemented by the Allies and the French Resistance. There was a plan to destroy electrical facilities, which was successful on the part of the French Resistance. There was a plan to damage rail lines and roads in order to make it difficult for enemy Nazi forces to potentially reinforce what they had at Normandy at the time. And then finally, there was a plan to cut underground telephone and teleprinter cables so that the different German commanders and different German forces could not communicate between one another. Again, this is yet another example of the difference between what Stalin and the Germans were doing on the Eastern Front and what Eisenhower was doing on the Western Front. Okay, so let's actually start talking about the 3 big campaigns that I'm going to highlight on the Western Front. One, of course, we talked about, which was the actual landing. This is the thing that the Russians tend to focus on, is the fact that it wasn't as hard on the West as the West believed it would be. However, I hope I managed to convince you that just putting the pieces together for that operation was a spectacular achievement on the part of Eisenhower and, of course, the rest of his generals. The second one is the Falaise Pocket or the Falaise Gap, which I'll talk about right now. And the third one is the Battle of the Bulge. So Falaise is known as the Falaise Pocket. the Battle of Falaise Pocket or the Battle of Falaise Gap. It's called the Falaise Gap because some Germans managed to escape complete encirclement on the part of the Western Allies because one British general was too stupid to do what he was supposed to do. That general being the famous General Marshall, Montgomery. But so yeah, a lot of people actually kind of refer to it as the Falaise Gap because about 50,000 Germans were able to escape and get away to fight another day, so to speak. But the Falaise Gap was the breakout from Normandy. So like I said, Normandy itself, the landing, they didn't achieve their objectives on the first day. It took them a while. Once they had the landing part was not too bad. For the guys who actually did the landing, of course, it was horrible. Imagine coming out of one of these little boat thingies, and you got to know that, like, the first guy off the first boat, is dead. I mean, you have these machine gun nests that are just literally all over the beach and obstacles and mines and stuff like that. I mean, there's just, I don't know how these kids did this. But yeah, I don't want to underestimate nor underplay the sacrifice that these men, young men, made at Normandy. But definitely, the first 24 hours were a success in the ability of the Western powers to be able to get a foothold on the beach. The problems start coming when they want to break out from the beach. Operation Overlord, which is what the actual operation was called, wasn't actually the operation for D-Day itself. It was the operation for the liberation of France. So the ultimate objective, of course, was capturing Paris. You got to break out from the beach in order to do that. And it took them a while. They pushed hard. They were able to, within a few weeks, they had landed a few hundred thousand troops on those beaches, and they very, very slowly start moving south. Now, if you kind of know what that area looks like from Calais down to, let's say, the Normandy beaches, kind of sloops down a little bit into the Normandy beaches and then goes back up again into this place called Cherbourg. It kind of looks like a peninsula. The idea was to capture that entire area. That would be the breakout, so to speak, from and the Falaise Pocket was precisely that breakout. So what happened? Well, the Battle of Falaise, or the Falaise Gap, or the Falaise, whatever you want to call it, that took place over a couple of weeks in August. Notice that you're still pretty close to the beaches, so you haven't. You're not getting off. You're not going to be kicked out of France anytime soon, but you're still pretty close to the beaches. It's still pretty risky for the Allies, and the Germans have been slowly moving assets from the Eastern Front to the Western Front, because for some reason Hitler became absolutely obsessed with the fact that the West had invaded. He started pulling resources away from the Russian front to help out in the Eastern Front. So things are, you know, the breakout in that what sort of looks like a bit like a peninsula wasn't exactly going as easy as everyone thought it would go. But eventually, a massive German army slowly became encircled by the Western Allies in the Falaise region. And that battle that took place was decisive, let's say, in the liberation of France or the liberation of Paris, because once they had cleared the gap, or cleared the pocket, so to speak, I mean, it was just almost, you know, easy pickings, so to speak, to get to Paris. They're going to have some trouble later on, a lot more trouble, actually, in what's called the Battle of the Bulge. They were caught by surprise, the Western Allies, I mean, they were caught by surprise by that. But the battle itself, the Falaise Pocket, It was decisive German defeat. Part of the reason for it, interestingly enough, and I want to do another series of podcasts on this, like World War II myth busting, was like just the bad planning on the part of the bad orders on the part of Hitler and the rest of his Nazis, who were telling the Wehrmacht what to do, and the Wehrmacht were telling the Wehrmacht being the German army, and the German army saying no, this is not a good idea. There's a lot of fighting going on between the Nazis and the German army. The German army knew that they would be annihilated, and Hitler said to the last man, typical of Adolf Hitler, sort of like in Stalingrad. But the fellow's pocket resulted in the destruction of 40 German divisions. That's a huge amount of equipment and men that were lost on the part of the Germans. It was decisive. No exact figures are available in terms of, you know, how many were killed. In fact, Eisenhower, flying over the Falaise pocket, could see nothing but bodies, animals, civilians, soldiers, because it was just such a small concentrated region where this fighting took place, almost like kind of like World War One style. But 40 German divisions were destroyed. It cost, historians estimate that more or less it cost the Germans about 500,000 men, with about 50,000 to 60,000 escaping because of Montgomery's mistake. 240,000 of those 450,000 were killed or wounded. Now the Allies, the Western Allies, had achieved this victory at the cost of, it wasn't cheap, didn't come cheap to them either. And you see, this is the part that the Russians don't quite acknowledge or don't quite know. Let's say, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. The Allies achieved this victory at a cost of about 200. This is like over, remember, this is over just a month's period, right? More or less. 210,000 casualties, 37,000 killed, 20,000 missing. The Air Force lost something like 17,000 airmen killed or missing in connection with that, the operation. These numbers include from the landings up until the end of the Battle of Falaise. But with that battle and this decisive victory on the part of the Canadians and the British and the Americans, it essentially left France open, and it made possible the liberation of Paris, which took place just a few weeks after the end of the Falaise engagement. Paris was taken. Paris was taken on the 25th of August, if I'm not incorrect, and Eisenhower, being the astute politician that he was, made sure that the French were the ones who did the liberation, as opposed to who really wanted to liberate Paris from the Germans, who was Patton. Patton was actually pretty pissed off about the fact that he was ordered away from the region to allow de Gaulle and his single division to liberate Paris. So liberating Paris, well, you know, it wasn't that hard a job, especially after what had happened at Falaise. But either way, it was important politically for France to be able to demonstrate that it was the French, and it was specifically de Gaulle, who had liberated the capital. And this is another aspect of Eisenhower that I didn't mention before, which was he had a very, very keen understanding of politics and of the political situation, and he was really good at working with people. I don't think any other, again, I'm going to say that I don't think any other person could have done the job that Eisenhower did. But anyway, so Paris is liberated on the 25th. The Allies keep on moving eastward towards Germany. The Germans are falling back. And then we get to the end of 1944, where, I don't know, Maybe there's a little complacency on the part of the Western Allies in that it was going to be a cakewalk now into Berlin. Well, actually, they were going to let the Russians take Berlin, but that's something for another podcast completely. But Western Allies kind of took their eye off the ball. So by the end of 1944, things seem to be in place as far as the Allies are concerned to make a move into Germany itself from France. But the Germans, after having, and this is important for this podcast series, after having moved some of the more significant, more well-trained troops from the Eastern Front, moved to the Western Front, launched a counter-offensive in the Ardennes forest near northeast France, Belgium, Luxembourg area. And it was, the intended objective of this counter-offensive, and it was going to be the last counter-offensive, or it was going to be the last offensive that the Germans are going to make. And after this offensive, which, of course, the Western Allies won, the rest of, Germany pretty much did become a cakewalk. But the objective of this counteroffensive was to try to take the Antwerp, the port of Antwerp in Belgium, and the idea there being to split the Allies into two, and that would put the Germans in a much better situation to maybe reconquer France. The German generals thought that this was a crazy idea, and like I said, I'm going to do another podcast about all the crazy shit that the Nazis, Hitler and his buddies came up with in the war, and how, thank goodness, the Nazis were running the show, and otherwise maybe the German army may have won the war. But the German army thought that this offensive was a crazy offensive. I mean, they were going to use some of Germany's last remaining best troops. They were going to use the Waffen-SS, the famous Waffen-SS. These guys were nuts. These guys were the SS, who were actually basically just murderers, but they were the armed SS, or the militarily trained SS, whereas the rest of the SS were just going around killing civilians. These guys were actually trained for military combat, and they were nuts. So these are essentially the units that Hitler throws towards the Allies in a complete total surprise in the 16th of December 1944. And again, like I said, the surprise came, I guess, partly because the Allies were overconfident. They were maybe preoccupied about their offensive plans. Although there were, if you've seen the movie The Battle of the Bulge, which is a really good film. Oh, by the way, this offensive is called, if I didn't mention it already, it's called the Battle of the Bulge. There's a movie called The Battle of the Bulge. If you see the movie The Battle of the Bulge, there's a scene where there's like this one British intelligence officer who seems to be getting information that some of these like Panzer SS divisions, like these German tank divisions, are in the area, and his superiors are just essentially telling him to, oh, just ignore that information. So, apparently there was some information that the Germans were actually going to launch an offensive, and it was ignored, at least as far as the movie is concerned. I don't see why the movie would lie about this, but so I guess it did actually happen. But either way, it took the Allies by complete surprise, and it was a brutal battle. Both sides took incredibly heavy losses. It was called the Battle of the Bulge because the Germans were able to kind of make a bulging, they were able to break the Allied front and bend it inwards and kind of like a bulge, if you know what I mean, hence the name Battle of the Bulge. But they were stopped around the area of Bastogne, And they've also done a TV series about this. If you've ever seen a series called Band of Brothers, the 101st Airborne Division is in Bastogne, in that region where I guess the tip of the bulge is, where the furthest penetration has taken place. And the 101st is holding off. And the thing is that they had to take, the Germans had to take that area, because that area essentially opened up the rest of the region for further invasion. So it was a sort of like a critical juncture, geographically speaking, that had to be overcome. But the 101st were able to hold out, and you see that in this series, like I said, Band of Brothers, which I really, really, really strongly recommend. It's fantastic. They held out. The 101st held out. Eventually, Patton was able to break off some of his tank divisions and head northwards. He was in the south, and head northwards towards Bastogne to relieve the 101st Airborne Division. Although the 101st veterans from that time, and you see this in the TV series, claim that they never needed the help. They never needed Patton's help. I think they did. But either way, I mean, these guys were heroes. They took the biggest beating from the Germans during the Battle of the Bulge. To make a long story short, this was, you know, Germany's last counteroffensive. Surprise, surprise, they lost it. And then once they lost it, they had lost. Remember, I mentioned that some of the best troops that Germany had were pulled from the Eastern Front by Hitler and thrown towards the West against the better advice of his own generals. It turned out to be a complete disaster for the Germans. They took very, very heavy losses, but so did the Allies. So here's where we go into the issue of numbers, and I think it's important to talk about numbers because this is yet another example of what the West did that I'm pretty certain Putin and the rest of his cronies refuse to acknowledge when they make the argument that, you know, they single-handedly won the Second World War. Well, to begin with, keep in mind, number one, that some of the best troops from the Eastern Front were moved over to the Western Front in order to face the Americans and the British and the Canadians. So that's number one. So the initial German attack involved 400,000 men. This is comparable to the kinds of attacks that would take place in battles in the Eastern Front. So 400,000 men, 1,400 tanks, 2,500 artillery pieces, over 1,000 combat aircraft. Some of these forces were reinforced a little bit later, brought up to a strength of about 450,000. It wasn't enough, though. Like I mentioned, you know, the 101st was able to hold out at Bastogne, and they couldn't get that crossroads area. The Germans were stopped, and then came the counteroffensive on the part of the Allies, which resulted in literally the obliteration of the remnants of the capable German army. If we're going to talk about one battle that literally gutted capable, well-trained remaining elements of the German war-fighting machine at that time, it was the Battle of the Bulge. And this is not to say that the Americans didn't take heavy losses. So the Americans and the British, actually most of the casualties were Americans in this battle. So as far as the Germans are concerned, it's estimated that about 100,000 Germans were either killed, wounded in action, or captured. The Americans peaked out at about 600,000 troops in terms of what they had deployed to defend and then to counterattack. 90,000 of which became casualties, 20,000 were killed. The Battle of the Bulge is the single bloodiest battle fought by the United States in the Second World War. and it's the second deadliest campaign in American history. This is what the source I'm looking at right now is telling me, so I don't know what the first one is. Maybe somebody could send me an email and tell me what the bloodiest campaign actually is. So like I said, so the campaign begins around the middle of December of 1944, but by February of 1945, it's petered out, and the Western Allies begin their counteroffensive in February of 1945. Essentially, what the Germans were able to do with this was delay the Allied advance into Germany by about a month. The Americans and the British, the Western Allied plan was to cross over into Germany the beginning of the year, beginning January 1945. The only thing that the Germans were able to do with this was delay this eventual crossing into Germany by approximately a month. By February 1945, the Allies were right where they had been before the offensive on the part of the Germans started in December. I mean, that was essentially it for the German army. At that point, Germans knew that the war was over. Maybe even probably Hitler knew that the war was over. You know, from that series that I was mentioning before, the Band of Brothers, a lot of the soldiers, the actors, of course, well, you're seeing them while they're in Germany, and they're commenting on how easy it is now that they're actually in Germany, that the heaviest fighting essentially ended as far as Germany is concerned. The problem that the Western Allies have to deal with now is this flood of refugees that are running away from the advancing Soviets, who are, well, not behaving very nicely and doing a lot of murdering, killing, raping, pillaging, etc., etc., etc. These people are actually surrendering to these surrendering to the Americans and the Brits and the Canadians. Germans are looking at the Allies as the Western Allies, of course, as their saviors from the Nazis, and their saviors from, of course, the advancing Soviet. So to give you some numbers on the devastating effect that this campaign had on the German army, remember, it took a heavy toll on the Americans. The big difference with the Americans is that they have, you know, GM and Ford and so forth, and also, you know, a lot more men that can resupply the losses so what I'm trying to say is that Americans have replacements. And that was a bad word to use back then, apparently. You can also see that in Band of Brothers, The Replacements. Look, on the 16th of December, the Allies have 200,000 soldiers. By the middle of January, that number's up to 700,000 in the area. Okay, so same thing in terms of tanks. The middle of December, about 500 tanks. By the middle of January, 2,500 tanks. Artillery pieces in the beginning of the campaign, about 1,000 artillery pieces. By the end of the campaign, 3,000 pieces. The thing is that the Allies can take the losses. The Germans can't. Let me show you what I mean about this. Early December, or rather middle December, 1944, like I said, the Germans start out with about 400,000, but by middle of January, they're down to 380,000. 550 tanks in the beginning of that campaign, middle of January, 200 tanks. What's the other number that I gave you before? Artillery pieces, 4 and a half thousand artillery pieces in the beginning of the campaign in December, down to 3,000 artillery pieces. The point here is that although both sides took pretty heavy losses, the Americans and the Brits were able to make up for those losses and deploy and redeploy a significant amount of troops into the area in order to halt the German offensive. And this is what the German generals knew. This is why they told Hitler that this was a crazy idea. Thankfully Hitler didn't pay attention, I guess. Here's another number here. In armored divisions, in the beginning of the campaign, the West has 2 armored divisions by the middle of January, 8 armored divisions, beginning of, in the area, of course. Infantry divisions, 6 divisions in the beginning of the campaign, 22 divisions, infantry divisions by the middle of January of 1945. Now, as far as the Germans are concerned, they start off with 7 armored divisions, and that number stays pretty much the same throughout that entire month. And in terms of infantry divisions, they start off with 13. So as far as the infantry divisions, the Germans start off with 13. So they did actually throw some pretty significant forces at the Allies in the beginning of the campaign. It was a weak spot. The area was a weak spot. But, you know, those 13 divisions become 16 divisions by the middle of January. In other words, this was a battle that Germany could not recover from. And this was a battle that, the Western Allies simply had the ability to throw more men and equipment into the area. And again, the German generals knew this. Hitler thought that he would succeed.
So the question that remains is, why do this? why create this mythology that the West did nothing? And it was created for essentially one goal: to discredit the West, to discredit the West in the eyes of his own Soviet citizens, but also in Eastern Europe, who he was gonna, come to subjugate, and wanted to make sure that, they had at least one reason for not wanting to side with the Western countries in the coming Cold War. This wasn't the only thing that Stalin did to try to discredit the West in the eyes of public opinion following the war. He, for example, the myth that Hitler survived the invasion of Berlin and was somehow whisked away to Argentina or the United States or whatever, that was something that was created by Stalin in order to discredit, another way of discrediting the West in the Second World War, to try to show that, that the West was actually secretly in an alliance with the Nazis and the Germans. I got to tell you, this is one of the most stupid. This one about Hitler escaping has got to be one of the most stupid things that people believe, because, first of all, the Russians were assigned to, let's say, liberate or occupy Berlin, and there wasn't an Allied soldier within like a couple hundred miles, for Christ's sake. Eisenhower, for a number of reasons, wanted Russia to liberate or occupy Berlin. Could have been maybe because he wants the Russians to take the losses. Could have been because he thought, this might be a cathartic thing for the Russians to do. But the point is that there was like no American or Brit within hundreds of miles. There's just no way they could have gotten Hitler out and helped them escape. So the point I'm trying to make here is that these myths, which we have now actually to some extent come to accept as kind of true, were politically motivated fabrications on the part of Stalin in order to bolster public opinion in the Soviet Union and the areas that he was occupying in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. So with that, episode 3 and this particular series of myth busting, World War II has come to an end. I hope you enjoyed it. The one I'm planning next is on the Nazis and the myth that they were, well, this part is a myth, that they were really evil sons of bitches, but they were really actually good military strategists. Utter nonsense. The Nazis were incompetent, and thank God that they were, because the German army may have been actually able to win the war if not for the nonsense decisions that the Nazis were making. So that's going to be the next series, Myth-Busting the Nazis. I guess I'll call it Myth-Busting the Nazis, why the Nazis actually sucked as military strategists. So I'd love to get some feedback, which I never seem to get any. Please try to give me some feedback on what you think. I'm enjoying this project a lot. The email for the podcast is perimeterpodcast1word@gmail.com. So I'll just repeat it very quickly again. perimeterpodcast@gmail.com. So have a good week, and we'll see you next week on Myth Busting the Nazis.